I have to admit, I've been here 8 years, and when I was hired for the job as the secretary for the school in the parish, they told me, there are people that come here randomly and want to see the place. And I said, okay, what do we do? Do I have to show them around? Well, you can, but normally we just send them to the chapel and go about their way. And I thought that was kind of a tragedy because this is such a magnificent building and so much history and so much Catholicness of our faith is here. And I thought the most of the people that come up here are not Catholic. So I really took it upon myself to say, well, maybe I'll start showing them around. But I knew very little. And they'd start asking me questions, and I didn't know the answer. So I went to this little book that the sisters sell in the bookstore called Architects of Faith. I read it about 20 times till I practically memorized it. Then I went to the numbers of people here in this parish who have been here way longer than me. And really, this is a little bit intimidating for me from the standpoint that there are so many of you that have been here so much longer than I and started this place. You are the pillars and the foundation of what is happening here. And I feel very honored and I'm very privileged, and I thank Father Mary Benedict for asking me to speak today. So I hope to do it justice, and the people that have been here, you can correct me later if I'm wrong. So I created a tour for the Mount, and I give a little bit of the history, and then I walk people around the building, and I point out different things, the artifacts and history, and take them to the library and the chapel and the history board that we have. We've just opened a new museum this year in honor of our centennial, and what used to take me 10 minutes when I first started, because I knew nothing, now takes well over an hour and a half. Because there is so much fascinating information about this place that it's just too good to leave out. And I thought, I have to tell those people, and I feel compelled to tell them because it's interesting and it's fascinating. So what I'm here today to tell you about the history of Mount St. Michael and what it was during all those early years of the Jesuits, and what we are continuing to do today as traditional Catholics. So, touching on what Father Mary Benedict said about Father de Smet, the Jesuits came to this area, and their purpose, they were missionaries. And they brought Catholicism and Christianity to the area. And the Jesuits were very influential, and they had a lot to do with the development of Spokane. People were coming to this area because of mining, because of agriculture. We have this magnificent river that runs through the city. And so they opened up the missions, and more people came. And the Jesuits went out, and they found more missionaries to come. And the Jesuits decided to stay here permanently here in Spokane, and they wanted to open a scholasticate, which was a school separate from the seminary. And so the Jesuits came, and the first mission was St. Michael's Mission. And on December 8th of 1866, Father Cataldo offered Mass in the first St. Michael Mission that was here off the Pion Prairie. And on Sunday, if any of you take the city tour, we're going to go visit that mission and actually get to go into it on Sunday. So anyway, that mission was opened, and more Jesuits were coming to the area. More people were coming to the area. They were catechizing the Indians. And the Jesuits said, you know, we're going to stay here, and we're going to open a scholasticate. And in 1887, they opened Gonzaga. That was the first scholasticate. And young men were coming from all over. They wanted to be Jesuits. They wanted to be trained by the Jesuits. And they were growing. Their numbers were flourishing. And several years after they had opened Gonzaga, they started to outgrow it. So they needed to open a bigger and better scholasticate. And they were going to go, to Santa Clarita, California. But in the meantime, another Jesuit had come into the area, and his name was Father Joseph Cataldo. And Father Cataldo lived up here on this bluff with the Native Americans. He loved it. He thought it was a beautiful piece of land. He just had to have it. And so in 1881, so this was before they opened Gonzaga, in 1881, he wanted to purchase the 1,000 acres here on the bluff. And he went to the Jesuit superiors and he said, I think we should purchase this 1,000 acres. And they told him, no, it was a bad idea. It was too much money. It was not a good investment. But I think he persisted and persuaded and they got his way. And in 1881, the Jesuits purchased the 1,000 acres here on this bluff from the Pacific Railroad for $2.60 an acre. Now, obviously by today's standards, that is amazing. But that was a lot of money for the Jesuits. They didn't have it. They borrowed, they begged, they, you know, whatever they could do to scrape it together. So the property was used as farmland. And in the meantime, now plans were underway to build Gonzaga. That opened. Men came. They outgrew. And they were going to go to California. And Father Cataldo says, but we own 1,000 acres here on the hill. Why don't we just stay here in Spokane? So guess what the deciding factor was as to why they stayed in Spokane? It was the weather. That was one of the main factors that prompted them to stay here. They felt, oh, Spokane has 180-something days of pretty good weather, and the winters were pretty mild, so, okay, we'll stay here, and we'll build this bigger and better Scholasticate. So in 1912, they hired a local architect from Spokane. His name was Julius Zietel, and they had already worked with him because he had helped design Gonzaga. And he drew up the plans, and they broke ground August 24th of 1914. They laid the cornerstone March 15th of 1915, and they moved in January 6th of 1916. Now, that's a very short amount of time. Now, not a massive amount of people moved in. Several of the priests and brothers moved in. The building was still being completed, and by 1917, the entire building was complete. The building is built in the shape of a cross. So the whole front part of the mount going out, going this way, that's the top of the cross, and this part of the building is the tail. It is a basement and four floors. It's built in what they call Tudor Gothic style. The original cost of the mount in 1915 was $400,000. Now, we all know what was happening in 1915, World War I. $400,000 is still a lot of money today, but $400,000 in 1915, I think we estimated it was like, over $2 million in today's standards. It was a lot of money, and the Jesuits did not have it. They borrowed every penny of it and relied on God's providence to pay it back. So they built this building. Dozen or so, two dozen men moved in by January 6th of 1916. The following year, the building was complete, and the rest moved in. There were over 200 Jesuits that lived here at any one time. You had the priests, who were the teachers, who lived on that half of the building. You had the seminarians, who were the students, who lived on this half of the building. And then there were 20 to 25 Jesuit brothers who took care of the farming, the cleaning, the maintenance, the cooking, all of that sort of stuff. And they all lived here in community under a schedule and whatnot. Now, the building, they were growing so fast that not even 10 years after they moved in, they outgrew the building and they needed to add on. So by 1929, they added what we call the west wing of the building. It's a little L-shaped piece of the building on that end. They added an additional 70 rooms and a library. And that addition cost $200,000. Now, in the original building of the mount, they used hundreds of labor union workers, and they did it in a relatively short amount of time. But this was a massive undertaking. This building is built out of brick, mortar, concrete, marble, plaster, rebar. The only wood on the building are the windows, the doors, and their frames, and some of the flooring. This was done purposefully for insurance purposes. Following the Great Spokane Fire of 1889, it wiped out the whole brand new city of Spokane. Nobody was allowed to rebuild with wood. So really, when you look at downtown Spokane, this is why there's so many historic sites here. Everything is built out of brick, concrete, cinder block, rock. Because of following the fire, nobody rebuilt with wood. Spokane boasts the most historic districts of anywhere in the state. There are 18 historic districts here in Spokane, and Mount St. Michael's is one of those districts. 55 acres of our 300 is zoned historic. We are also on the National, State, and Local Registry of Historic Places in the United States. Now, that doesn't give us funding, which is what we really need to maintain a 100-year-old building, but it gives you bragging rights, and it protects the building from being destroyed. So, of the stuff that they built here, the basement and four floors, there's over 177 doors. There are 655 windows, not including the 12 windows in the library and the 8 large stained glass in the chapel. It's a lot of maintenance. It's a lot to keep up. But the Jesuits had 20 to 25 brothers who took care of all that maintenance. We have one. I think it's incredible. I tell... Ed Knoll and all of our previous maintenance men from the past, Benny Halfkamp, Mr. Carpenter, Mr. Drayman, all of these people who were the maintenance people around here know what an absolutely huge nightmare that is. I describe Ed on my tours when I'm talking to complete and total strangers, I describe Ed as our triage nurse. Okay? He goes from one broken down faucet, corroded toilet, which I'm sure you've all witnessed that in some of these bathrooms, to a broken boiler pipe in the winter, to a sewer rupture out on the front lawn, to raining in the building, to, you know, lights that don't work, etc. So truly it is a monumental task to maintain this building. But the Jesuits had a whole crew of people. And in fact, of the 1,000 acres that they had here, 700 to 800 acres of it was a fully working farm. They had all their livestock, they had their orchards, they had their fruit and vegetables. They supplied the food to the 200-plus men that lived here, and any surplus was sent down to Gonzaga that was continuing to operate. This was considered a fully functioning little city unto itself. They had everything they needed. They had their own bakery that was open to the public. And I think I read somewhere that the Jesuit brothers would give away cookie samples to the public. They had their own barber. They had their own tailor. They had their own shoemakers. They had their own bookkeepers. They had their own maintenance and groundskeepers and everything. They made their own candles. I mean, they were completely self-sufficient. Now, how did they haul all of this brick and mortar and concrete and marble and all of these materials up the hill? Well, I'm sure some of you have driven the switchbacks, as we call it. We sit on a bluff that's 320 feet high. It's solid basalt rock, so it's a very hard volcanic rock. They had to dynamite to clear the land. And in fact, down in the basement, there is a huge rock that the Jesuits tried to blow up. And you can probably, I think I've counted 15 or 18 holes where you can see where the dynamite was put in, and the rock would not budge. So when you walk down in the hallway in the underground in the basement, there's a wall, kind of a little wall built around the rock. So basically they gave up and they just built around it because this thing would not budge. So we're on this solid basalt rock, and they hauled all of this material up the hill. And how did they do that? Well, Father Arthias, the Jesuit who was in charge of construction, he built a 1,110-foot railroad up the front of the bluff. Now, it kind of had to zigzag its way because it would have been too steep to come straight up. It had an engine and two cars, and it could haul 6 tons of material up and down the hill. And that's how they got all of this up here. Now, show of hands, anybody, you want to guess how many bricks are on the building? It's a really big number. No? No guesses? Tom? What's that? More than a million. Mr. Drayman knows. 2.5 million bricks on this building. And I've had the great honor and privilege to go to the Jesuit archives several times in the last recent years to do a lot of my research and to get pictures and things that we have displayed. And it's taken me 8 years to figure out where the bricks came from, but I have finally got the answer. The bricks came from a local brick foundry just about 20 miles north of here in a little town called Deer Park. And the company was called the Washington Brick and Lime Company. And that's where the bricks came from. And they hauled these 2.5 million bricks here. And they used these hundreds of labor union workers to build this mount in a record amount of time and a record amount of money. So it was a huge undertaking for them. Now, while the Jesuits were here, they would, after they finished their novitiate years and did some studying in philosophy and theology and Latin and history, they would be sent to the Scholasticate for 3 years, where they would further their education in the philosophy and theology and the higher maths and science. This was considered a premier science academy. It was considered one of the finest Jesuit houses in the world at the time. And so they would come for 3 years, study, and what was so amazing about what they did is they studied all of these things in Greek and Latin. Latin specifically, they wrote it, they were required to speak it, read it. I mean, who does that today, really? I mean, yes, our kids study Latin in high school, but not in any comparison to how the Jesuits studied. And they were considered the cream of the crop. And as Father said, you know, it is a tragedy as to what has happened to the Jesuits. But these men were, they were the great doctors of the church. They were the great men of the church. They were the intellectuals. And they were smart. And they were very hands-on in the building of this building. The Jesuits had, obviously, they had the 1,000 acres and they had the farm. When they first purchased the property, they surveyed the property looking for water, and they couldn't find it at the top of the hill. So the smart men that they were, they went to the bottom of the hill. And on the corner of Lincoln and Freya, right now there's a trucking company there called URM. And, of course, the Jesuits were there long before URM, but there's a little brick house there on the property, and it is the well. And the Jesuits hand dug it. It's 165 feet deep, hand dug, and the water pumps up the hill. And up here at the top of the hill, there's a 100,000-gallon reserve cistern here at the top. And then we have a backup pump and generator in case we lose power. But in any case, this is why we have fairly decent water pressure and good, clean, cold tasting water most of the time. If you smell chlorine coming out of the fountain, well, just let it run for a while. But most of the time, the water is clean, cold, tasting, and I think that's ingenious that they would go to the bottom of the hill and actually pump the water up. So what happens is the cistern fills, it supplies the building, and as the cistern lowers, it triggers a signal to the well, and it pumps more water up. Out here, outside, I don't know if any of you have been outside and seen this tall cement smokestack just here outside this outbuilding. That was the exhaust system for the boilers. Now, the bishop made comment about not getting heat back when he was here in the 70s. Well, guess what? We still don't get that much heat, even now. We are lucky in the wintertime to get about 3 to 3.5 hours of heat in the winter. Depending on what the temperature is outside, the sisters fire up the boilers in the morning so that when we come to school, it's fairly warm in the small offices and classrooms. As long as you keep the doors closed, it can stay warm in there for quite a while. But then it shuts off. And then, depending on what the temperature is, we might get some heat in the afternoon, but we might not. So you just get really excited when the heat goes on. We wear many layers in the building. We allow the kids to wear their leggings and Under Armour and jackets and all kinds of stuff to keep warm. And as I tell my general public tours, I tell them most of my tours for the public who are not Catholic, it's almost a catechism lesson. I tell them, well, you know, as the sisters tell the children, it's about being sacrificial. It's about making sacrifices. It's about offering it up. And they laugh, and they think that's funny. I said, no, truly, that's what we do. We don't. You just have to deal with it. You don't have a choice. And somebody says, well, why don't you just plug in a space heater? Okay, if I have a space heater in my office, and Reverend Mother, who's next door to me, turns on her space heater, and Father Casimir, who's across the hall from me, turns on his space heater, Guess what? We don't just blow those three offices. We blow the entire floor. And the breakers in this building are in the strangest places. So you just try not to. And hopefully those of you that are staying in the guest rooms haven't experienced that. If too many of you plug in a hairdryer or a razor or an iron or some other kind of device like that, you could very easily blow the breaker. So if your lights go out, that's why. And hopefully we can switch the breaker back on for you. So the heat, we get a little bit. When the radiators and the, or excuse me, when the boilers are on, the heat that comes out of the radiators is awesome. We're on the original boilers. We're on the original boilers. Parts have been updated and things have been added to make things more safe. But for all intents and purposes, there are a lot of original parts still on the boiler system. But we don't use the smokestack anymore. When the Jesuits were here, they had two brothers who took shift round the clock, and they shoveled wood chip and sawdust into the fire that heated the water that comes through the pipes, that comes out of the radiators as steam. I jokingly said to Reverend Mother a few years ago, well, if we ever needed to go back to some really hardcore manual detention, maybe we should convert the boilers back to wood and, you know, we could get more heat. But that doesn't happen. We don't have too many detentions, thank God. So, but the boilers ran on wood chip and sawdust from 1915 until the late 40s when it was converted over to natural gas, which is what we currently use. But it's very expensive to run natural gas in such a massive building. The ceilings on the first floor are 15 feet high with 10-foot windows. All the buildings, all the original buildings combined square footage is over 187,000 square feet. It's a lot of square footage to heat. This dining room, we heat it only on occasion, special occasions. Fortunately, this year for conference, it hasn't been too cold, so we haven't had to turn them on. But in years past, we've had the heat going for a conference. We'll turn it on for the school Christmas program, maybe some other event that's happening here. But really, during the school day, when they say, kids, go get your hot lunch, and you come back to your table, it's cold lunch. So it can be very, very cold. In the library, so cold, so big of a space, we never heat the library. You can see your breath in there in the wintertime in the library. The chapel has its own separate heating system and air conditioning system, so we do get some heat in the winter and some nice, cool air conditioning in the summer. All of the windows are original. You cannot put Home Depot or Lowe's vinyl retrofit windows on a historic building. So we are in our sixth year of window restoration on these windows for the building. Now, a lot of people say, why are the windows frosted glass here on the first floor? Well, the room that we're sitting in would have been called the refectory, and this is where the Jesuits would have eaten their meals each day. It would have set up on long tables, kind of in chow hall style dining, and the frosted windows were dual purpose. One, it was to protect the privacy of the Jesuits. Not that there were a lot of visitors up here, but there would have been deliveries and other reasons for the public to come. So it was to protect their privacy, but more so, it was to keep the Jesuits from the distractions of the outside world. This flooring in here is original. It's maple and birch. The kids eat lunch in here every single day of the school year. We use this for conference. We use it for our auction. We use it. It's truly our multi-purpose. It's our theater. It's a multitude of things. To give you just the orientation of the building, the chapel is directly above us. This whole half of the building on this side is currently the convent. But when the Jesuits were here, it was their, the priests would have lived on that side. Their infirmary was on that side. And the seminarians lived on this half of the building. The center of the building, room 200, room 300, and room 400, which make up the very center stack of the building, those were their large classrooms, their science labs and their lecture classrooms. And all of the guest rooms that most of you are staying in here would have been their sleeping quarters. It was not called a dorm room. It was called a cell. And it was one man to a room, had a very simple bed, desk, dresser. The sinks are all in there. They would have shared community bathrooms. And over any one time, over 200 plus men lived in this building. Currently, we have in this building our parish, which has about 350 registered families. We have 52 families in the school that make up 131 students, K through 12. We have 28 students in the high school, 20 students in the junior high, and the balance is made up of K through 6. We have 39 religious sisters, 22 that physically live here during our school year. There are 8 at the novitiate, 1 postulant, 2 white veil novices, 3 blue veil novices. We have 3 nuns that run a school in Tacoma, 2 that run a school in Colorado, 2 that help work and run the school in Michigan, and 2 sisters at the mission in Boston. So when they're all home, there are 39 of them. We're very fortunate and we're very, very blessed to have our wonderful sisters who run and operate this school. Now, as the bishop spoke this morning, as he was speaking, I was thinking, he's stealing my talk. when they sold, well, the building was vacant. The Jesuits were here, and in the 60s, when things started to go south with Vatican II, all of a sudden this building dropped down to less than 24 men living here. And the building was for sale for many years, and then there was word that a developer was going to come in and tear down the building. And there was a group of traditional Catholics here who thought, we cannot let that happen. This is too important. So a small handful of people joined together. They pooled their money. They formed a small corporation, and I think it was called Pillar. Am I right, Mr. Draymond? Pillar. And they approached the Jesuits, and the Jesuits sold them the property for $1.5 million in December of 77. There was about 700 acres that they purchased somewhere. The Jesuits must have sold off a couple hundred acres. And what they did is they parceled off several hundred of those acres into 5 and 10 acre parcels up here on the bluff. And they sold it off to parishioners. And over time, that paid off the note to the Jesuits. So quite providentially, I think this is why we are still here in this building, is that there is no mortgage on the building. We can't afford to put a mortgage on the building. Don't even know how much the building's worth. I mean, it is kind of a unique building. It is a landmark here in Spokane, and we're very fortunate to still have it. What we currently own is roughly 300 acres. About 145 acres of it is zoned agricultural. We have the wheat field here at the bottom of the hill, the wheat field out here to the back, that kind of fallow land off the side of the hill over there, and a little bit out here to the east side where the rectory is. And we find clever ways of earning some money for ourselves. So the 100-year-old smokestack that we no longer use, you may have noticed there's this strange contraption on the top of it. It's a cell phone tower. So we rent out our 100-year-old smokestack as a ready-made cell phone tower and generate a little bit of income that way. We also rent out the wheat fields to a wheat farmer who takes care of it, plows it all, and splits the proceeds with us. And between the cell phone tower and the wheat field, it just barely covers our property taxes. Now, you're probably thinking, property taxes? Aren't you religious, nonprofit, tax-exempt? Well, yes, we are. The state of Washington says it only applies to 10 acres. So we have to pay property tax on the rest. So we find these clever ways. And, of course, I'm preaching to the choir here when I tell you, and I tell my tour groups, we are independent of the Diocese of Spokane. We do not support the Diocese of Spokane. They do not support us financially. They know we're here. We know they're there. And we like it that way. So we have to find clever ways to raise money for ourselves. And we run this place on volunteerism. We require our school students to do goal hours. And all the students that you've seen working here the last few days and will continue through the weekend, they are here voluntarily. And they are giving their time to earn their service hours for the school and the parish. We require our school parents to give 90 hours of service. this is how we take care of this massive place. We don't have paid janitorial. We don't have paid groundskeepers. Brother Sebastian does the mowing and he trims trees. But the kids help rake leaves and people help work the flower beds and they pull weeds and they vacuum the church and they do flower arrangements and they make hosts and they, you know, take care of all of the cleaning and kind of other needs that need to be taken care of. And that's how we get it all done. We have a magnificent group of parishioners who just give so much of their time. It's amazing to me. I'm so edified to see just people here all the time donating and working and giving of their time, no matter what it takes to keep it all running and keep it all beautiful. So we're so, so fortunate for that. I want to tell you about the chapel really quick. I am giving a tour of the Mount on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and all of this that I'm telling you now, I won't have to say on Sunday. I'll just be able to walk you around the building. But I want to tell you about the chapel really quick. The chapel does not look anything like it did when the Jesuits were here. Unfortunately, the Jesuits removed everything. They physically destroyed the altar. They took out the pews. They took out the communion rail. They took out the statues, everything. The only thing, there were a couple of things that survived. The light fixtures that hang from the ceiling, obviously the stained glass windows, but there was one piece of the altar that survived. It's called the frontispiece. It's a bas-relief of the Last Supper. The Jesuits pulled that off, and if I'm not mistaken, I think was sold down to an antique store down in Hilliard, which is a little down here at the bottom of the hill. Years later, a parishioner was shopping and saw the piece and knew what it was, and they bought it, and they brought it back here, and renovation was made to this altar to receive that original piece. We do have a couple of the original pews. They're up on the sanctuary, and there's a couple of them in the choir loft. They got rid of the pipe organ. They pulled it out. It went to a theater at Gonzaga, and we just found out a couple of months ago that they just parted it out for parts, which is just tragic. So anyway, the chapel underwent a major renovation between 1989 and 1991. There was a large Catholic orphanage in Superior, Wisconsin called St. Joseph's, and that orphanage had been opened, well, before 1915, obviously. I'm not exactly sure when it was opened, but close to 100 years. And the bishop that opened that orphanage, his name was Bishop Augustine Schinner. And he actually ended up being the first bishop of Spokane. And he blessed the cornerstone of this building in 1915. So it's quite providential that the orphanage that he established in Wisconsin, all of the artifacts, all of the altars and the reliefs and the angels and all the statues was all saved and brought here to this chapel. So the story goes that this orphanage was going to go under the wrecking ball, and somebody here contacted the sisters and told them, if you want it, come and get it. So four sisters, two brothers at the time, went to Wisconsin. They spent a month or two there. They had to chisel and crowbar the stuff off the walls themselves. They didn't have any money, so they had to go begging for materials to build crates. And I was just confirming with Sister Mary Josephine, when they went around to several businesses to try to procure wood to build these crates, she wasn't having any luck. So they started praying to St. Joseph. Please, St. Joseph, we need materials to build these crates. So finally, I think it was their third stop, they went to this place, and the guy walks out, and Sister says, gosh, you know, we're trying to get this. We don't have any money. I'm trying to build these crates, etc. And he says, no problem, sister. They call me St. Joe. His name was Joseph. And he gave them what they needed, and they built the crates, and then they had to go beg a trucking company to ship it all back here. And that took a little bit of effort, back and forth, trying to negotiate to get the trucking company to bring it all here. But it took a big semi to bring back everything that you see in the altar, and then, in the chapel, and then some. The chapel in Wisconsin of the orphanage was called the Chapel of Angels. And there were so many angels to the set that our chapel couldn't even house them all. So almost all of the parishes, the CMRI parishes, have something from that orphanage in Wisconsin, whether it's a set of adoring angels, the pulpit, the communion rail. We have the bulk of the set. The main altar, the two side altars, the two beautiful reliefs that are on the side altars, and all of the cherubs and all of the angels that you see in there. There are over 54 angels on the main altar and sanctuary, and I know because I've counted them so many times, and I've even had to confess to Father, I was distracted during Mass because I was counting angels. Because I couldn't believe it. I couldn't find them all. But they're from the smallest little cherub face, about the size of a 50-cent piece, to the big, huge ones that you see hanging on the walls, to the ones between the windows at the back of the church, the holy water font angels. So there's over 80 in our chapel. And the story goes, the bishop who opened that orphanage, his policy was every time an orphan child was brought in, another statue or image of an angel was added, and the child was told, that's your angel. So every single one of these angels in this chapel represent these orphan children. And like I said, there was so much to the set that this chapel couldn't even house it all, that all of our parishes around have these angels and statues. Let's see. I'll save the rest for my tour on Sunday. So if you want to know more, we'll take you into the library. We'll take you to the museum, to the chapel. And a special treat in honor of the centennial, I have permission from Reverend Mother Mary Agnes that we will get to visit the convent cloister chapel. So if you want to see that, you'll have to come Sunday afternoon. I think I have 5 minutes, Father. Are there any questions? Yes, sir. That would be Mr. Tom Drayman and Larry Uran. They were the two. In fact, if you can, please raise your hand, Mr. Drayman. He's right here at this front table. Mr. Drayman, he is really the instrumental. And Carl South, too? Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. We're so grateful. We would not be here if you had not persisted. Yes, Susan. Her question is, were the Jesuits aware of the corporation were a bunch of traditional Catholics? Mr. Drayman, they were? Oh, he told them. They probably didn't like it, but he told them, right? After you won it? Not before. Afterwards. He told them afterwards. Oh, after they signed the papers. Well, we're very grateful for that. Yes. Father Dennis did all the begging for the mount. So God rest his soul. Yes. We are so grateful for that. Okay, one last little thing. There are a lot of things out there in the community and a lot of people out there that have no idea who we are, what we are, what we're doing here, or there are some really crazy stories about what people think this place used to be and still is. So this is what I tell people, and some of the things that I've heard. Oh, I thought you were an insane asylum. I thought this was a prison. I thought it was a winery. I thought it was a library, a school, a hospital, a mental institution, a nunnery, a convent, a monastery, a vacant haunted castle. It's just crazy what people think. But this is my little joke that I've told the sisters. On any given day, our teachers might feel like it's an insane asylum. On any given day, our students might feel like it's a prison. And at the end of the week, we all wish it were the winery. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. God bless you.